Good morning on today's programme. Hot and bothered in the UK, where the Tory leadership contest takes place against a backdrop of industrial unrest, and how a small village street sign in Slovakia is stirring the ghosts of its Nazi past. But first to Kenya, where voters went to the polls on Tuesday to elect a new president, as well as members of the National Assembly and Senate. There are still no official results, and a big talking point has been the low turnout. But while the long count and the close contest has kept much of the nation in suspense, young people are asking, will the results make a difference? From Kenya, Sally Hayden sent this report.
On Friday night, Kenya's NTV television station broadcast footage showing a pendulum. It swung between the country's two leading presidential candidates, reflecting the confusion of much of Kenya's roughly 55 million people who have been waiting for days to find out who will be their next president. The East African country went to the polls last Tuesday to vote for politicians at every level, but the turnout was noticeably low. Less than 65%, down from 79% in 2017. Many young people did not even register, with some telling me they are fed up of politics and politicians and could not imagine any change no matter who they supported. But others are heavily invested, so much that there are ongoing concerns about whether violence will break out once the winner is announced. The leading candidates are two of Kenya's wealthiest men, who have been involved in politics for decades. Current Vice President William Ruto, a 55-year-old self-proclaimed hustler, comes from a poor background. He used to work as a chicken seller and says he did not own shoes until he was a teenager. "Hustlers start from the bottom and go up," said George Wanjiru, a 34-year-old Ruto supporter who runs a motorbike shop called Kwa Hustler in Nairobi. "Many Kenyans are very rich, but most are very poor," he said. "We need a president who knows what is poverty and what is being rich, so they can differentiate." Incumbent President Kenyatta and Ruto came to power together in 2013 in what many called an impunity alliance. Both men were facing charges of crimes against humanity from the International Criminal Court for their alleged involvement in violence after the 2007 elections, during which more than 1,000 people were killed and hundreds of thousands displaced. The charges were later dropped or dismissed. Ruto is up against 77-year-old Raila Odinga, a long-time opposition figure who has run for president four times before. "I've been hearing about the things Odinga did for this country. He fought for democracy and human rights," said one of his supporters, 23-year-old Diana Bocheberry. "Old is gold," she added. "He's so old, but so wise." In 2017, the latest election, dozens of people were killed after Odinga challenged the results, with Kenya's Supreme Court eventually ordering a rerun, ending up with the same winner, a second term for Kenyatta. Kenyatta and Odinga are the sons of Kenya's first ever president and vice president, but their fathers fell out, leading to a long rivalry. Because of their history, millions of Kenyans were astounded when they formed an alliance in 2018, posing for a picture of a handshake that went public. Kenyatta has now served his two allowed five-year terms and is standing down. He's backing Odinga. This high-level support was obvious in Odinga's final star-studded campaign rally, which saw performances from a host of popular musicians, including Tanzania's Diamond Platnumz, who reportedly flew into Nairobi on a private jet before dancing on stage with the candidate. But while polls had Odinga winning with 52%, the final vote seems to be much closer than expected. In an effort to make this election the most transparent yet, voting totals from more than 46,000 polling stations were posted online, meaning media companies and political candidates could try to add them up themselves. This meant a few days of nail-biting updates, where Ruto would inch ahead, then Odinga, then Ruto again. Suddenly, the independent tallies stopped just short of declaring a winner. Now everyone is waiting for Kenya's Electoral Commission, who are verifying physical forms at the National Tallying Centre and have not given a definite date for when they expect to deliver. But some are asking themselves, will the eventual winner even matter? Kenya is regarded as East Africa's most stable democracy, but the low voter turnout indicates that many citizens have shut off from politics, tired of what they see as endemic corruption amid unaddressed problems, including high youth unemployment and issues around tribalism. This is a country where the president admits that around 2 billion Kenyan shillings, more than 16 million euro, is lost to corruption every day. Young Kenyans aren't angry, they're just tired, said 20-year-old Hope Sinjuma, whom I met in Mukuru informal settlement, one of the poorer parts of Nairobi. Everyday politicians tell you tomorrow will be great, but you lose patience. Politics is gambling. It's like playing with cards. Someone can talk good in his or her manifesto, but when they go to power, it doesn't change, he said. For World Report, this is Sally Hayden in Kenya.
It's been a long, hot summer in Britain, where the current Tory leadership race is taking place against the backdrop of a cost-of-living crisis fuelled by soaring inflation. Amidst the political uncertainty, the country's experiencing a wave of industrial action, which is rapidly gaining momentum, with unions from a broad range of sectors announcing strikes. As Lorraine Malander explains, union leaders have harnessed the national mood of discontent, but with Liz Truss now bookies' favourite to replace Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, pledging a crackdown on industrial action, could a general strike be on the cards?
It's been called the summer of discontent. For the past month or so, as temperatures and inflation have risen to new highs, Britain has been rife with talk of paltry pay rises, lousy working conditions, fat cat salaries, colossal corporate profits and strikes. It's all looking a bit 1978. This was the year of the infamous Winter of Discontent, a Shakespearean phrase borrowed by the then editor of The Sun to evoke those freezing months which saw over 2,000 strikes held during a period of high inflation. The disruption brought down a Labour government, ushering in Margaret Thatcher, who introduced new laws aimed at crushing union power. These were tested by the miners in their unballotted 1984 strike, which culminated in violent clashes between pickets and police, ultimately ending in submission. Now, mass industrial action is back on the agenda. The past weeks have seen transport and telecoms workers on the picket line, and it seems likely that they'll be joined by firefighters, teachers, doctors, nurses, civil servants, post office and council workers, and even barristers over the rest of summer and well into the autumn. In the space of a few weeks, once obscure union leaders have become household names. Enter Mick Lynch and Eddie Dempsey, representing the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union, which has announced more strikes at the end of this week. Both Londoners from Irish families, they've been running rings round TV interviewers with their ability, seemingly rare in today's media-saturated world, to simply tell it like it is. Initially, interviewers with memories of the 80s miners' strikes evoked old tropes of clashes on the picket lines. "Are you a Marxist?" asked one breakfast TV host interviewing Lynch. But soon it became apparent that there was something else going on, and it wasn't necessarily all about the Communist Manifesto. Today's wave of industrial action seems to have less to do with ideology, more to do with people simply being fed up. Lynch's calling out of fat cats and rampant corporate profits have hit home in a country tired of wage freezes and spiralling energy prices, with bills set to go through the roof in October. Lynch's straight-talking style, laced with droll humour, have made him a bit of a TikTok sensation with over 20 million views. "I could be selling more records than Beyonce off of that," he tells World Report. But on a more serious note, he adds, "I'm not in this game to get a profile. I'm conscious I've got to get a deal." Another union leader hitting the headlines is Big Dave Ward of the Communication Workers Union, whose members in the postal and telecoms industries will be striking over 5 days bridging August and September. Ward has hashtagged British Telecom CEO Philip Jansen "Food Bank Phil" after the company set up a food bank in a call centre in Tyneside, offering basics like oats and pasta for staff whose pay wouldn't stretch until the end of the month. Jansen recently accepted a pay rise, bringing his annual earnings to £3.5 million a year. It's a bitter pill to swallow for the tens of thousands of workers who kept Britain connected during the pandemic. This week, Lynch and Dempsey joined forces with Ward and other public figures to launch Enough is Enough, a campaign aimed at fighting the cost of living crisis, with 50 rallies in the offing. "We're not all in this together. We never have been," says Dempsey in a campaign video. "The people who are in this together are working class people who've been mugged for too long." Much of the campaign's focus is on pushing for wage increases, removing focus from the tax cuts currently being touted by Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, the odds-on favourite to replace Boris Johnson as Prime Minister on the 5th of September. As inflation soars and people edge closer to the financial brink, there's been a notable silence from the top. Johnson and opposition leader Keir Starmer have until recently been on holiday. Starmer recently earned brickbats from the left wing for sacking a frontbench MP who gave broadcast interviews from a picket line. There's a sense of a political vacuum which the unions have readily filled. How big could this get? There's talk of a general strike, the first since 1926. This still seems unlikely given that it would need to be called by the Trades Union Congress, which would have to rally its members, big and small, radical and moderate, around a common cause. But Liz Truss's pledge to introduce new rules within her first 30 days in office that will restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike could yet turn out to be that cause. The TUC's General Secretary, Francis O'Grady, recently told the Financial Times the proposals amounted to a fundamental attack on a fundamental British liberty. Either way, another winter of discontent could be on the cards. For World Report, this is Lorraine Mallander in London.
And finally, there's a fresh row in Slovakia over the refusal by a village council to rename what is the country's only street sign honouring Slovakia's wartime fascist leader, Monsignor Jozef Tiso. All but one council member in the village of Varen voted to abstain from the motion, saying it should be put to local residents in a referendum. Rob Cameron has more.
Varin is a small, rather unremarkable village near the city of Žilina in central Slovakia, but it's been in the news for all the wrong reasons. Village councillors there have refused a request from prosecutors to rename its most famous street, which bears the name Dr. Jozef Tiso, a Catholic priest who became the president of the Nazi puppet Slovak Republic in 1939. The council voted to abstain, saying the matter should be decided instead by local people. Only one woman, who lives in the street and objects to it being named after a man executed as a war criminal, voted in favour. The street was renamed Tiso Street in 1993, shortly after Slovakia became independent following the breakup of Czechoslovakia. Ironically, it had previously borne the name of Ladislav Pfliegl, a Slovak war hero who had died in an uprising against the Nazis in 1944. Jozef Tiso, in fact, has no connection at all to Varin. Tiso is a controversial figure. He's revered by supporters on the far right and ultra-Catholic circles as the man whose alliance with Hitler protected Slovakia from the worst of the Second World War. But he also oversaw the deportation of an estimated 70,000 of Slovakia's 90,000 Jews to Nazi Germany, including all 25 of Varin's Jewish families. They were eagerly rounded up by Slovakia's paramilitary Hlinka guards, and most of them were murdered in the Holocaust. In an unusual twist, Slovakia was one of two countries that actually paid the Nazis to take their Jews, 500 Reichsmark ahead, on condition they never return. Croatia's Ustasha regime did something similar, though paid far less. Tiso's defenders say he was unaware of their ultimate fate and unable to alter the course of the Holocaust. Contemporary historians snort at that, pointing out that he actually tried to deport Slovakia's Jews to Hungary as early as November 1938, as head of the so-called Autonomous Slovak Region. They managed to come back. Hungary didn't want them, but they didn't survive for long. Not even appeals from the Vatican stopped the deportations, and many speeches show Tiso as a virulent anti-Semite. Tiso fled the advancing Red Army in 1945, making it first to Bavaria and then Austria. Caught by the Americans, he was tried and executed by the Czechoslovak authorities in 1947. But his Aurora remains, powerful catnip for the far right, which has made a resurgence in Slovak politics, and also for some rogue bishops, one of whom has spoken of wartime Slovakia as a time of well-being for Slovaks. Maybe it was, unless you were Jewish. Outsiders might presume the Varian case will in some way be cathartic for Slovakia. Finally, it has a chance to exorcise the ghost of Jozef Tiso once and for all. But commentators say people, especially young Slovaks, are simply bored of the saga, and indeed it no longer makes the kind of headlines as an Adolf Hitler or Benito Mussolini Street would make elsewhere. The people of Varian will have a chance to change that if there is a referendum in the autumn, but not everyone is holding their breath. For World Report, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week, but until then, from myself, Mary Regan, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.